It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court will hear arguments this week over new legislative maps for the state. We check in on the 8 dueling maps and where it could all go from here. First, millions of Americans are at higher risk for severe disease or death from COVID-19. That includes people with underlying health conditions like obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, older people, and people with intellectual disabilities who research has shown are 6 times more likely to die from COVID-19. Most states don't have mask mandates in place, raising concerns that people who are at risk will be even more vulnerable. The Americans with Disabilities Act mandates that public spaces, jobs, and schools be accessible to people with chronic illnesses and disabilities. Some lawsuits have been filed arguing that this 1990 law should apply during the pandemic to decisions that could put people with disabilities at a higher risk. We're talking about the intersection of disability, the law, and the pandemic, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one have a disability or chronic condition that puts you at higher risk for severe disease or death from COVID-19? Do you want to see places like your local school or workplaces require masks? What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court overturning the Biden administration's workplace vaccine mandate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Professor Peter Blank is a university professor and chairman of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He's an expert on disability law and co-author of the treatise Disability, Civil Rights, Law, and Policy, which explores the legacy of the Americans with Disabilities Act and cases that came following the passage of the law in 1990. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Delighted to say hi to all my friends in Wisconsin. Spent many years there.
Well, welcome back then. Well, before we get into the Americans with Disabilities Act, as it relates to COVID, can you give us a quick reminder, a quick overview of the kind of protections and guarantees that come with the ADA?
Well, at the highest level, if there was one examination at the end of a law school 3 years that could cover every single aspect almost of the law, from constitutional law to administrative law to health law, you name it, they would be well suited to ask a question about what we're talking about today. And the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is one piece of this very complex social, cultural, and economic question during this emergency, which relates to the ways in which people with disabilities can be equally included in society. And the ADA, in a nutshell, is a very comprehensive law. It's one of the most comprehensive in the world. It was passed in 1990, and it covers employment, it covers educational issues, it covers state and local government operations. It covers private entities like hotels and businesses and restaurants. So it's quite a comprehensive law. And at the end of the day, if you are deemed covered, we can talk about that, as a person by the law, as a person with a disability for purposes of the ADA, then you have protections with regard to not only anti-discrimination in these areas, but the affirmative obligation to provide what's called reasonable accommodations or changes to the way things are done that don't create a hardship for the entity, but still allow people with disabilities to participate equally.
Let's dive in now to some of the ADA issues that have come up during COVID-19. Here's one of them. Last year, parents in 9 states sued over mask mandate bans in their school districts. So states, in many cases, said schools can't issue mask mandates. The parents here say, you know, banning these mandates discriminated against their kids with disabilities and chronic conditions who are at higher risk. In effect, saying without masks present, our kids are at higher risk. They don't have an equal opportunity, an equal platform in these schools. Can you talk about how the ADA does, and I guess doesn't apply here?
Well, this is being fought out in courts across the country with different results. There's a case in Texas right now that's dealing with some of these very same issues. In a nutshell, again, to what extent is it discriminatory and exclusive if your child cannot attend public school because they have asthma, a chronic health condition, immunosensitivity, pick your condition, and if masks are not used in the classroom, then they are super susceptible to getting sick, and therefore any reasonable parent would not send them to school. So the question is, can a state, and a school district would be a state entity, either enforce or not enforce such mandates? And to what extent would they exclude children who otherwise should and would be able to go to school with some form of accommodation? And the courts have been mixed on this question. As you said, in Florida and elsewhere, the state governments have opposed these mask mandates. 9 states, I believe, require most people, California, Hawaii, New Mexico, I don't believe Wisconsin is one of those, that have a mask mandate mostly indoors. But a lot of the, in the school districts, there's a lot of debate and issue about whether these should be enforced. For example, people might say under the Constitution of the United States that if their children are forced to wear a mask, this could conceivably influence their freedom of speech, their freedom of religion, and other civil rights they might have under the Bill of Rights.
Talking to Syracuse University law professor Peter Blank about the Americans with Disabilities Act and COVID-19 regulations, mask mandates, the absence of mask mandates, and vaccination requirements we'll get into. You could join in with your maybe experiences, maybe as a person with a chronic condition or a disability. Do you feel limited in what you can do based on Wisconsin's current status of no mask mandates, no vaccine requirements? Or do you worry that it's an imposition, maybe even discrimination against some people to require vaccinations or masks? If you have a question about how this all works in the law, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, there's also been talk about discrimination related to vaccination, or I guess in this case, unvaccinated status. One bill currently in the Wisconsin legislature would ban schools from discriminating against students based on vaccine status. Now, this would be a state law. I don't think this is invoking the Americans with Disabilities Act in any way. Is there a claim from someone under the ADA who says, yeah, my workplace can't make me be vaccinated? I would view it as discriminatory against me under the ADA.
Well, yes, it could be discriminatory, hypothetically, if for some religious or medical reasons, the person could not take the vaccine or wear the mask. And as a matter of fact, those are the types of cases that are percolating through the courts. So the ADA has been interestingly applied by both opponents and proponents of these mandates and these vaccination requirements. The historical basis for this goes back to about 1905, when the Supreme Court decided a case called Jacobson v. Massachusetts. And in that case, an individual, Mr. Jacobson, opposed being vaccinated for smallpox, as was required of adults in Massachusetts over age 21. In fact, he had had a bad experience with a smallpox vaccination type opportunity or experience when he was in Sweden, and he didn't want to repeat that. The Supreme Court held, basically, that while you're always weighing competing interests, in this case, it was a legitimate purpose of the state to care for the public health and safety, and therefore to enforce the vaccination requirement. Now, the United States Supreme Court, of course, has come out differently depending upon the nature of the employee, if it's a federal employee or a state employee, the nature of the business, if it receives federal funds or if it's a private business. But there really is no definitive answer yet as a legal matter with regard to some of the issues you're talking about.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joshua is with us in Madison. Joshua, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question for Peter.
Go for it.
So my question, Peter, is most accommodations, at least in my imagination, are not burdens on each and every employee in the workplace. So a reasonable accommodation might be a ramp or additional parking. So isn't the idea of masks as a reasonable accommodation different because it burdens each and every employee rather than, say, the employer as a whole?
Interesting question, Joshua. Yeah.
That's a brilliant question that many of us have been thinking about, Joshua. And to put it in a complimentary way, when you think of an accommodation, it's typically for the particular individual, say, to wear a mask in an environment because he or she might be susceptible to a medical injury. But now this is kind of flipped so that in order for that individual to be protected, everybody must wear a mask as a reasonable accommodation. And I would say that there are precedents for that in this area. Now, a reasonable accommodation, as you said, Joshua, cannot dramatically disrupt the nature of the business financially or programmatically. And the individual cannot necessarily pose a health threat to others in the workplace. So there are limits on this concept of reasonable accommodation. But you raise a very good point, which is also unsettled. To what extent must others in that environment affirmatively change their behavior so that they can accommodate the person who is susceptible with a disability? And there are examples of that. For example, regular health requirements in the workplace and other sorts of changes in workplace safety and other sorts of issues. But it is a complicated question, particularly when that individual's accommodation may affect literally tens, hundreds of other people in the way they engage in the workplace. Very good question, Joshua.
Thanks for calling in, Joshua. Peter Blank is a university professor and chair of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He's talking to us now about disability rights during the pandemic and the Americans with Disabilities Act. You could join in with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have a disability or a health condition that makes you high risk when it comes to COVID? What has your experience of the pandemic looked like? Do you think that not having things like mask mandates could violate your protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act? Or in general, do you have questions about how this all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about disability rights and the pandemic. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned President Biden's vaccine or test mandate for businesses, saying the federal government is overstepping its bounds. We're looking at vaccination requirements, mask requirements. There are lawsuits aplenty out there. We're talking to Syracuse University law professor and disability law expert Peter Blank about how the law protects and does not protect people with disabilities or chronic conditions during the pandemic. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Well, I'm curious. You know, those of us that have disabilities, we try to protect ourselves, and we go into certain environments, whether it be Walmart or grocery stores or sports activities where people are not wearing masks. So what about empowering us to say, okay, we're going to start lawsuits against these places that are not enforcing or requiring people to wear masks? I mean, we're at a disadvantage here, and I think maybe we need to start empowering ourselves and saying, okay, we're going to start lawsuits. What do you think?
Peter, what do you think?
Well, it's a very good question and comment, Susan. I should say, as you well know, Susan, number one, the disability community is not at all monolithic on these issues. Disability for all of us who are touched in different ways is just a natural part of what we're experiencing in life. And so people might disagree even within the disability community. But, Susan, now you're talking about another area of the law, which is quite interesting. I'm not aware of such lawsuits, and that is basically negligence. And that of reasonable care. If somebody with a disability and a susceptibility were to go into a hotel or someplace else or a restaurant, and in fact they were not diligent reasonably to protect that individual who may or may not choose to wear a mask, then there is potential for the type of litigation you're talking about. It's less available under the Americans with Disabilities Act and more available under traditional what's called tort or injury litigation.
Susan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Peter, something I saw in the news today, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up a challenge to a federal mask mandate on public transportation. Well, I got to wear a bus when I get on, or a mask when I get on the bus to come to work in the morning. You have to wear one on airplanes. And there was a challenge from a citizen who said, yeah, me and my kid, we can't wear a mask for long periods of time. The U.S. Supreme Court saying we're not going to take that up. So that one stands. Do you see other potential avenues for somebody to challenge that federal transportation mask mandate under the ADA?
Well, that's very interesting. I actually hadn't seen that yet, but, you know, this issue really goes to the nature of society as a whole and group interests versus individual rights. And it even, it, of course, transcends the law, the dialogue we're having here now. And I haven't seen that decision. Maybe there's a dissent by the justices who I would expect to dissent. But the federal government, through its Department of Transportation, certainly has the authority to promulgate such requirements. Obviously, they were challenged, and the Supreme Court chose not to take it up. Depending upon the composition of the court, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but certainly it could have come out differently. And so it's a very interesting time in the law because of this terrific social, cultural, political overlay, which is in large part driving these outcomes. Now, why did the Supreme Court not take this up? I'd have to look at the decision. Am I surprised? Not particularly, given the nature of the makeup of the court and the focus on individual rights, religious rights, speech rights, all of which could be potentially implicated by such a requirement.
We're talking to Syracuse University law professor Peter Blank about the Americans with Disabilities Act, disability protections, and requirements, mandates for masks and vaccines during this COVID-19 pandemic. Still time for you to join in if you have a question or thought at 800-642-1234. Peter, the Americans with Disabilities Act was not written and passed during a major global pandemic. Is it being stretched, tested a lot in this unusual circumstance we've seen for the last couple of years?
Well, that's another very interesting question. And I would say it's almost completely true what you said. To some extent, aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act in its passage and the early case law was influenced by the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. And as a matter of fact, the first case involving disability decided by the United States Supreme Court, a case called Bragdon versus Abbott, was about a woman with asymptomatic HIV disease and whether a local dentist was required to treat her in his office using universal precautions, you know, in a safe way, even though it was against his ideas about how he'd like to practice. And the United States Supreme Court ruled that the individual's rights trumped in that case, and it was discriminatory for the dentist, in this case, to fill a cavity, not to fill the cavity of this woman named Sydney Abbott because she had HIV disease, and because he could have done it in a way that was safe. But they considered that an element of discrimination. So in many ways, the ADA was influenced by, wasn't a pandemic certainly, but certainly a major health crisis. And the early cases went to such sorts of decisions. Another case in which I was involved with before the United States Supreme Court was what it called Chevron v. Achazabal, was essentially whether or not an employer had to hire an individual who had a particular type of liver disease and might be harmed by working in that environment. In that case, the Supreme Court said they did not have to hire that person because his health condition could have worsened in the environment and would have been a direct threat, so it's called, to his and others' safety in the workplace. So it's really a complex area, but the ADA certainly has not been immune to these sorts of questions prior.
And Peter, just in our last minute or so, you mentioned earlier a lot of these cases making their way through courts, into legislatures, and more. What are some of the questions you are interested in seeing courts answer over the next few months or so?
Well, I think this education question is really important for so many of us. People who have children with disabilities or health conditions, and universities, of course, and other sorts. But so how do we balance the obvious protection for health and safety with our individual rights, our fundamental rights to speak freely? Some people say wearing a mask shows a political form of speech, you know, forces a political form of speech, that you are basically speaking as the government would like you to speak. Can you argue with that in good conscience when it's brought, you know, by reasonable people? And that's what makes these cases so complex. It transcends health, and it goes to essentially how we view the nature of our rights in a republic, and to what extent can those rights be compromised or changed as a result of this unprecedented health emergency. And we're just going to have to wait and see how the courts, almost on a daily basis, are grappling with these sorts of questions. And it's unlikely then that we'll see one sort of national ruling or order, given the complexity and the variations among the states and districts, businesses, and so forth.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and I look forward to hearing more about your views on this issue.
That's Peter Blank, university professor and chair of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He joined us for a look at the Americans with Disabilities Act and how it applies to pandemic protections. Still time to share your thoughts on these issues over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court will hear oral arguments tomorrow over 8 proposed maps for the state's legislative and congressional districts. The redistricting process in Wisconsin has gone to the courts after the Republican legislature and Democratic Governor Tony Evers failed to agree on new maps for the state's elections. The state Supreme Court previously ruled that they will try to make as few changes to the current maps as possible. We're checking in now on how the line drawing process has gotten here and where it could go now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see the courts handle Wisconsin's district maps? Have you looked at the proposals? Do you like one over the other? Do you have a question about how this all works? Do you think it should work differently than it does? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast and the WPR Podcast Mapped Out. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
You've been following this process a long time in the podcast and in regular reporting. Sean, what exactly is happening tomorrow?
What's happening tomorrow is that everybody who has come to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and presented justices with proposed maps gets a chance to make their case before these justices. You know, you have 8 different people seeking to, you know, guide the court here. They all get 30 minutes to make their case and then an additional 10 minutes for rebuttal. You can imagine with some question and answer sessions and maybe a break here and there. It could be like a day-long hearing before the court, which is really not the norm, where they usually have arguments that last more like an hour.
8 maps, Sean, which is 6 more than I would have guessed going into this, because, you know, the governor, I knew he did one, and lawmakers, of course, passed their map. Where are those other maps coming from?
We've got a bunch. So we've got, as you mentioned, the governor, you've got, which is different than the People's Map Commission map that he endorsed earlier in the process. This is something that he developed for this lawsuit. You've got the Republican legislature's map. You have the Democratic state senators led by Janet Buley, the Senate's minority leader, have presented a map. You have something from Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, Voces de la Frontera, League of Women Voters, and other groups who are parties, many of them, to a federal lawsuit involving redistricting. They've got a map. You have another group of Democratic plaintiffs, including Lisa Hunter, They filed the first federal redistricting lawsuit. They've got a map. You have some citizen mathematicians who have a map, and then you have Republican congressmen who have a map. So pretty much everybody has a map, Rob.
All right. I didn't make a map. I feel kind of
I'm
left out now.
I'm surprised you didn't submit anything, frankly.
Well, I like maps, but I'm not good at drawing, so yeah. I think they would have thrown mine right out. Okay, how much difference is there amongst these eight maps?
So I think there's difference in kind of key metrics. I mean, you can definitely look at them, and they're going to spend hours, you know, parsing these details tomorrow at this hearing. So I don't want to, like, downplay the differences in the maps. Mm. But big picture, the conservative justices on the state Supreme Court have said, we want a map that is a least changes map. So they already came out in November and endorsed this idea that was presented to them by the conservative law firm Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, that if the court is going to decide this dispute, it should basically change as little as possible to the current map, since the current map was passed by a legislature and signed by a governor in 2011. So their argument was, it's not really for the courts to get involved and draw these maps on their own. So if the court has to be involved here because Governor Tony Evers and the Republican legislature aren't going to agree, the court should make the least changes. And conservatives on the Supreme Court agreed to that. So even though you have very different, plaintiffs in this case, I shouldn't say plaintiffs, you have very different interveners in this case. You know, you've got Tony Evers, the Republican legislature, Republican congressmen, they don't really agree on too much, but because they're following this least changes directive from the court, all of these maps are really good for Republicans.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, about the latest on Wisconsin's election maps, the lines that are being drawn to say who gets to vote where. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The state Supreme Court considering eight alternatives. Do you have questions about how this is working? Do you think that this idea of going as close as possible to the current maps is a good idea? Or do you have concerns about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. That idea of as close as possible to the current map, Sean, might not sound controversial, but it is because of what came out of that first map. Can you talk about why some people really didn't like that idea?
Yeah, I mean, the first map was a very partisan map. It was drawn by Republicans, you know, signed by a Republican governor, and it helped preserve big Republican majorities in the legislature, even in years when Democrats, you know, did well in statewide elections. I think even compared to other maps around the country, it has proven to be, you know, a very strong Republican gerrymander. And so essentially when the court endorses a least changes map, even though, you know, legally speaking, they can make their case pretty clearly on why they did that, the practical effects of endorsing a least changes map is that you are endorsing, you know, one party over the other for the next decade. You know, that is to say that they're going to make sure that this map that was drawn in 2011 will, you know, in some form live on for another decade until really the 2032 election, unless it's changed along the way over the next decade.
All right. So least changes to current map. That's what the state Supreme Court said their basic principle is. But we have eight different maps. How are the different parties here involved saying, yeah, my map is a better one than these other ones that still is consistent with this least change idea?
So for this, yeah, I've kind of relied on research that's been done by John Johnson, a redistricting expert at Marquette University. And he looked at some of the categories that the court might look at in terms of least changes, you know, because that term could be in the eye of the beholder, right? So one of the things that he looked at was the portion of the population that would, you know, remain in the same district, or put another way, you know, which map moved the most people from one district to another. And under that metric, Governor Evers' map is actually the least changes map. It moves the fewest people around from one district to another. So that is one argument I'm sure you hear the governor's attorneys make, is that, you know, they essentially did the homework assignment that they were given by the state Supreme Court. It's not the governor's first choice. His People's Maps Commission would have actually moved a lot of people around from district to district, but they had a different objective than the one that they drew for this lawsuit.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the redistricting arguments set to face the state Supreme Court tomorrow. These are going to set the lines for the next 10 years, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to this redistricting issue? Are you angry about it? Do you have concerns about accusations of gerrymandering? Or do you think that we should stick with the current maps as they are, as close as possible? Some changes do have to happen because people move around. Do you want to see us do this in a different way? Right now, the legislature makes a map, the governor signs it or vetoes it. When that happens, it goes to the courts. 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your thoughts, your opinions, your questions for Sean. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief, with us today talking about Wisconsin's redistricting process. It is still going on. It's now before the state Supreme Court. Big hearing with different maps tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Not hearing from a lot of you right now. Usually in the past, people have been pretty angry. I have a lot of thoughts on redistricting on all sides of the issue. Maybe it's people are resigned to what's going on now. Are you? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on how things are working, how it went last time, questions for Sean, if you think there's got to be a better way, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sean, is this kind of all over, but the Supreme Court ruling, people are kind of resigned to, we're going to get something kind of like what we have now?
I mean, if the Supreme Court gives, you know, what amounts to, maybe not the final say, but given the amount of say that they're going to have over this process, if they have come out and said, you know, we want a least changes map, you're going to get a Republican map. But there is sort of a degree of how Republican when you look at options that are on the table for them. You know, the map that was drawn by the legislature that they passed, that the governor vetoed, it makes it really hard, would make it really hard for Democrats to ever kind of threaten a majority in the Wisconsin legislature. You know, you would need really kind of a, you know, previously unforeseen Democratic wave in Wisconsin to, you know, get a majority in the assembly under that proposal. If you look at the governor's proposal or the proposal drawn by Senate Democrats, it'd still be tough, but you wouldn't need as large of a wave here to kind of knock on that door. I think another way of looking at it is if the Republican legislature's plan were to become law, that gives them a very real opportunity to potentially get a veto-proof supermajority in the legislature where they could override a governor, whereas if some of these other proposals that are on the table become law, that'd be harder for Republicans. And so if you're talking about a veto-proof supermajority where they could override a governor's veto, that's obviously pretty consequential compared to not having that. You know, right now, even though we always talk about how Republicans have big majorities in the state legislature, they don't have that veto-proof majority in the assembly. So that'd be a big deal.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Okay, you asked for our opinions. My opinion is that it's really not democracy. If you take a vote, let's say Waukesha County is a good one where they've got that drawn up like it looks like, you know, the map of Los Angeles County and not in squares. Those people, when they vote down there, that are especially the Spanish-speaking people down in Waukesha, their votes are diluted gone is that why do they even vote? Because they're not getting anything. They wash it into another spot. Their votes are gone. And the other problem I have with it is my son watches this all the time. And Robin Voss, who's the main, you know, the guy who's really behind this, and he would have lost by now. He two times there because of gerrymandering, he got saved. The other thing is, if you have something you're doing that the people hate, you know, whatever it is, the gun control, marijuana, you know, legal in Wisconsin, whatever it is, if you have something you don't like, these guys can vote any way they want out there in Madison because they can't get unelected.
You know, Robert, I got you. You gave us a lot to work with there. Sean Roberts' objection, one that people often raise when it comes to so-called gerrymandering, is it makes lawmakers ultimately less accountable.
Yeah, it definitely reduces competition, especially under the latest plan passed by the legislature. You would have even fewer competitive seats. You know, some of the districts that are somewhat competitive right now would be, you know, flipped to both safe GOP and safe Democratic in order to kind of get the desired result for Republicans under the map they passed in the legislature. And when you're talking about what that means for public policy in Wisconsin, I think there's a pretty compelling argument to make that the map does affect that. You look at something like, let's take medical marijuana for an example. There are very few issues that poll as high as, you know, support for medical marijuana. In this divided state, this is something that people from both parties agree on, and it's a issue where other states have moved forward on legalizing marijuana for medical use, and that's just something that hasn't happened here in Wisconsin. And there's not a real threat of electoral repercussions for not moving on that. At least there hasn't been so far, and that's the evidence that we have.
Thanks for the call, Robert. We'll go next to Eric in Kaukauna. Eric, hi.
Good afternoon. My question is, I think the entire matter of districting in the current form should be discarded. We should go to a model that allows an independent partisan committee with public oversight, a committee that's qualified in terms of statistical analysis, to do districting for us, because either party could abuse the current system of allowing one party to district every 10 years. I think it's wrong, and it would level the playing field considerably and make each party more responsible to all of its constituents, whether they be supporters or non-supporters of that particular party, and provide a more intelligent conversation as opposed to the current blockage that we seem to have created for ourselves.
Eric, thanks for that call. Sean, some states do it that way with some version of an independent commission. There have been advisory referenda, I know, in many Wisconsin counties or localities calling for that. There really hasn't been much movement on that idea at any point in Wisconsin, has there?
No, there hasn't. I mean, and when you're talking about popular ideas, it's not as popular as medical marijuana, but the public is strongly behind the idea of some kind of a nonpartisan redistricting proposal. There was a bill, and there has been a bill introduced that would take a stab at this in Wisconsin. The past several sessions, it's modeled after Iowa's longstanding redistricting system. It would require the legislature's nonpartisan attorneys to draw the next boundaries for Wisconsin's assembly, Senate, and congressional districts. Lawmakers would have the final chance to vote them up or down, but there are all sorts of kind of mechanisms built in there to try to prevent partisanship from playing a role in that system. That just hasn't gone anywhere since Republicans have controlled the legislature. It is worth noting that when Democrats controlled the legislature, you know, way back in 2009 and 2010, ahead of that wave election, there were Democrats who wanted something like that passed. And that's, you know, they didn't pass it then either.
Thanks for that call. Lynn joins us next in Hustisford. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I kind of agree with a couple of the last people that there has been some movement, some people around the state wanting to have some kind of bipartisan redistricting. But a lot of us have just kind of given up because it seems that no matter who is in charge, they don't listen to what we want. they do what they want, and we can't vote anybody out because of the way the districts are gerrymandered right now.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Sean, a concern about gerrymandering is, yeah, if you, even if we don't like what you do, we can't really vote you out if everybody's in a safe district on either side.
You know, you can see the argument. For as competitive as Wisconsin's statewide elections are, and nobody would say that they're not. You know, we have had the closest, among the closest presidential elections and other statewide elections, you know, races for governor, state Supreme Court, you name it. It's about as close as it comes here because our state, our electorate, is about as divided as it comes. And so those races are highly charged because anybody could win any given year. It's just not the case in the legislature when you're talking about control of the entire legislature. So it does take some wind out of the sails in terms of, you know, which party's going to be in control.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Julian joins us next in Wauwatosa. Julian, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm just calling, like, where is the one person, one vote lawsuit in all this? My understanding is that for the last two elections, numerically, the votes have gone roughly 60 to 65% for Democrats. But then the result is we end up with a 60 to 65% or greater Republican control. Like, I'm one person. My vote is supposed to be as equal to someone who lives way out in Iron Mountain. But what's happening is, like, these areas are getting representatives for the land and not for the people. And the land doesn't do anything. We're the ones that do it.
Julian, thanks for the call. Sean, you tracked that lawsuit in the Mapped Out podcast, federal lawsuits saying Wisconsin's lands did, in effect, violate constitutional laws, but it didn't end up taken in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, that was a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit. The idea that, I mean, it was based on the idea that at some point a gerrymander can get so partisan that it violates the constitutional rights of voters in the other party. That was the argument Democrats made and made successfully at the district court level. They won there. But the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately said in another case that this is something that the federal court system is not going to deal with. You know, they use the term, it's non-justiciable or not justiciable. You just can't do it in the federal courts. It's not for the federal courts to decide when something gets too partisan. So nobody's saying that partisan gerrymanders don't exist out there. The federal court system, at the direction of the U.S. Supreme Court, is just saying, we're not going to deal with that. Go ahead, sorry.
I just want to say, in our last half minute or so, Sean, on a related note, Stephen Door County wants to know if something's going on with this redistricting process in federal court.
Yeah, I think once the state Supreme Court does whatever it's going to do with Wisconsin's map, you are then going to kind of see this dormant federal lawsuit be revived. They'll be focusing likely on any potential violations of the Federal Voting Rights Act and how people interpret that. So they're not looking at changing the whole map there, but if you are talking about changing the boundaries for some districts in southeast Wisconsin around Milwaukee, it could have a domino effect and make changes elsewhere.
Sean, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. You can find out a lot more about redistricting in Wisconsin with the Mapped Out podcast that Sean co-hosted. You can find that over at WPR.org. And you can follow reporting on tomorrow's hearing before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. 8 legislative maps coming their way. A hearing, big hearing tomorrow.